after you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other, Morty. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children that replace them when they get too old to make power.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
And free enterprise. Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust? Not a chance. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of really inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
I am not getting caught up in your bourgeois capitalist money-making scam.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the hosts and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is key. Sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
Didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
Welcome to the Three Lefts podcast with your host, Daniel Platt, recording here in Albany, New York. First few episodes will be more experimental, just to try things out. But more or less, what I'm going to do this show is to cover two topics, one relating to sustainability and one relating to security. I'm doing both from a far left point of view, the left of left of left. Socialism, sharing economy, shared work, shared property, shared resources, but without the hierarchy, without the bosses, without orders. Other shows, I can go deeper into that, but right now I'm just laying out that this is the way I talk about things is from that perspective, left of left of left. And what are these three lefts? Well, in America, first left is usually referred to as the left, usually the Democratic Party, or in the corporate media, the left, which mostly refers to liberals. Liberals, with capital L, I would call moderates. They are pretty much for the status quo, how things work, but, you know, they're within a very defined margin of error. Left of them are what we usually call progressives, or democratic socialists like Bernie Sanders. A lot of progressives are in the Bernie Sanders camp in this presidential election. They're supporting him, they're petitioning, and that's all well and good. Progressives are, these days, as one, are a conservative force, if you think of it as, well, they want to conserve the welfare state. It's old enough that it's been around, and they want to conserve it. They don't want to move past it, they don't want to expand. Some want to expand it, as democratic socialists do. But they don't want to change the inherent structure of it. They don't want to change how it works, how it demeans those who are on welfare. One way of going past this is with a basic income. Left of progressives, left of people like Bernie Sanders, are usually the ones who get the least play, not even the small amount that Bernie Sanders gets. These are radicals. These are anarchists. These are people in the still alive Communist Party, Socialist Party of America. They could be Greens, as I am. Generally, when you go left of left of left, you're talking about people who are anti-capitalist, anti-state. They are very much for many things as well. Humanitarian rights, socialism, but also anarchy. anarchism, or rather the practice, only having authorities that can substantiate their claims to it. But that's a lot of heavy stuff, and I prefer that this show stay away from that. I want this to be introductory. I don't want this to be the kind of show to scare people off, so to speak, or to go over anyone's head, to not so much use simple language, but of course start with simple things, things that are happening in the news, but not so much mainstream news. There's so many different sources where you can get left-wing, even hard left-wing, radical left perspectives on regular news, the presidential race, the latest tragedy, the latest hullabaloo, the latest celebrity gossip, or the latest social issues. But I want to go beyond that, or rather, I want to go to the undercurrent news. Still news, still being reported, but not so much, but it's under the radar. It's less than superficial. Rather, it's journals that can be hard to digest. And for that, I can kind of be a guide. Similar to how podcasts are good for digesting a lot of news, it's like having someone read the newspaper to you. But a lot of newspapers are going out in the new media. It's the magazine that's king. Not only the print magazine, but also the online magazine. And just as some online magazines are doing well, others are not so. Or rather, there's just so many of them. So many news magazines. Rather, there are the magazines like The Nation, Mother Jones. It's hard to keep track of them all. It's hard to read all the good content that's out there from Mother Jones. And these are publications that have been around a long time. They're not new media. But there is new media. Online magazines that have only been online. And I'm thinking of picking one and going through their last four articles, or picking a few that look interesting to me, or could be interesting to you, listeners, and going through them. I could just read them off, add a little commentary now and then, and I'll be following my nose, because usually, say, these publications will have a similar bent that I would. I won't identify them. I'll come through to them as I go. But this first episode, I'm going to not focus on one magazine, but I'm going to focus on four. So I'm just going to get into it. I'll also add that I want to talk about anarcho-socialist solutions, or left solutions, so you can get a better handle on what is left of the left. You know, what is left of what corporate media calls the left. It's so saturated, this picture of what the left is. Is it all just social justice warriors? And that's actually a good segue to the first story. Now, the first story is about sustainability, particularly solar power. So this comes from a more a local magazine for a story that got shared quite a bit in environmentalist circles, which I happen to. And it was, I think a lot of people missed the point of it, or rather, I had a different interpretation of this story. And the story, in a nutshell, is that a town rejected a solar farm, superficially because they're Southern hicks. But that's rather classist. And I'll explain how. So, a town of Woodland, Woodland, North Carolina, I'm assuming, was going to vote on, its town council was going to vote on a proposal to rezone a section of land for a solar farm. Solar farm is going to be built by a company called Strata. There's already three other solar farms previously accepted by the town council, with one now in the process of installing solar panels. So two have already been built, one is currently being built, and now a fourth is being proposed by this company. The solar farm companies are seeking placement around Woodland, because it has an electrical substation nearby, where the solar power generated by the panels can be added directly to the electrical grid. Strata's proposal would have completely encircled the Woodland substation, meaning that it would be completely surrounded. Later in the meeting, the town council voted for a complete memorandum on solar farms. How and why? During the public comment period, So these are the people speaking, the people, or people of the town. Certainly democratic to actually have a public comment period and taking them seriously. Citizens expressed distrust and fear of the solar panels. John Barnes said she represented many citizens who rejected any more solar farms coming to Woodland area and presented a petition to the council. All very grassroots. Barnes asked that any future solar farm requests be placed on a referendum so the citizens can make a decision. Also seems fair. Referendums are good. It's direct democracy. Mary Hobbs, a woman named Mary Hobbs, had been living in Woodland for 50 years and said she had watched it slowly become a ghost town with no job opportunities for young people. She said her home is surrounded by solar farms now and is no longer worth its value because of those facilities. This is what she perceives. She added that the only people profiting from these solar farms are the landowners who are able to sell their land to the solar companies and the electric companies. The next speakers were named Bobby and Jane Mann. Jane Mann said she was a local native and concerned about the natural vegetation that makes the community beautiful. Now here's where we get into nut territory, because she says some pretty dumb things, or rather ignorant, but that itself is no excuse to make fun of people in a small, rural, southern town, because these towns have really had nothing. But she was a retired science teacher, and is concerned that photosynthesis, which depends upon sunlight, would not happen and would keep the vegetation from growing. She said that she observed areas near solar panels where vegetation is brown and dead because it did not receive enough sunlight. Are you following this? She also questioned the high number of cancer deaths in the area, saying no one could tell her that solar panels didn't cause cancer. Quote, "I want to know what's going to happen," she said. "I want information. Enough is enough." Sound familiar? "I don't see the profit for the town." It's a very important line. "I don't see the profit for the town." She doesn't see how her town benefits from these solar farms. "People come within agendas," she said. "Until we can find if anything is going to damage this community, we shouldn't sign any paper." Bobby Mann said he watched communities dry up when I-95 came along and warned that would happen to Woodlawn because of the solar farms. "You're killing your town," he said. "All the young people are going to move out." He said the solar farms would suck up all the energy from the sun and business would not come to Woodlawn. It would seem like he's saying something that's the opposite of what one would expect, that solar energy can bring more businesses. But if that were the case, then I don't think these people would be in an up. I think what they're saying is that there has not been an upsurge of any business or doing a business just because these large companies have plopped down solar farms in their town. And it goes on to say that they're not getting any power discount from living near them. There was no deal. Only $7,000 per year for specialized training to their fire department in the event of an electrical malfunction at any of the solar plants. So it's not like they're buying them anything. It's not like they're even bribing the town. So Strata then addressed the council. The company, Strata, then addressed. They had several company reps. Three spoke. They changed the plan to increase the setback from the road and said the solar farm would have a substantial amounts of vegetation. So the rep that spoke was named Trahos. She said there were no negative impacts on property values statewide. Solar farm is wonderful use of a property like this. The town would not benefit from a tax-based standpoint from the solar farms because they are not located within the town limits, but only in the extraterritorial sections. So that's important. Another rep, Neiman, said that only sunlight the panels use to generate power and which hits them directly. Panels don't draw additional sunlight, he said. Power generator would go directly to the grid and would not reduce Woodland's power bills. Then they go on, there is no toxic materials on site. This is a tried and true technology, yada, yada, yada. Generally speaking, I've gone to enough city council meetings in which large companies present to know that reps, even when they're telling the truth, seem like they're hiding something, that they're full of shit. especially when they're not offering anything. And in my own city, we've had people selling casinos and other things, and they offer a lot. You know, they offer that they will add to the property tax base. They'll pay, you know, help pay for the schools. They offer jobs. What is the solar farm offering the town of Woodland? Is it offering jobs? No. Is it offering more of a tax base? Well, no. Is it offering a break in their power bills? This is energy right in their neighborhood, and apparently they're not benefiting at all. So in that case, why wouldn't the local population petition and react badly, even out of ignorance? Even from a science teacher who thinks that brown vegetation around solar plants must mean that they're getting less sunlight. Being someone who knows more about these things, it's actually more a matter of heat gain. The solar panels draw in, put out a lot of heat, just like any solar oven or piece of metal left in the sun. It gains heat. That heat goes into the ground. Hot ground means dead plants, or it harms the plants. Just like anything that's exposed to high amounts of heat. But that's not something that matters in particular to this. That's just the information that these rural southern folks don't have. What they see is their town is lifeless, that it's been sucked dry from neoliberal economics, however you want to think about it. Whether it's jobs outsourcing, you know, stuff like that. And they don't see things coming in. What they do see coming in is a large company building something on their meadows and open space, taking it from them. They see something being taken, and they don't see anything coming back to them. So why shouldn't they oppose this solar farm? Especially when the defense from their these company rats, these corporate representatives. They talk like corporate representatives. They seem to be addressing just very superficial complaints. Oh, there's no toxic materials used, so it won't give you cancer. Maybe there's something else in the area causing cancer, old industry perhaps. But it's like trying to prove a negative. They should be talking about the benefits, but if they're not able to talk about benefits, it's because none exist, at least not for the residents of Woodland. And then in lies a lesson, that if we're going to do something as good as growing solar power, having more sustainable energy, it needs to benefit everyone. It can't be in the form of a big company to just replace the utilities. It can't be the big utilities that have a monopoly on a market and they just switch to solar. I mean, it's good for the overall planet, but there's no economic justice in it. And there's no social justice. And in that, people will still be unequal, separated. You're going to have all sorts of problems. You're going to have opposition. And that's something a lot of liberals, moderates, don't seem to get. You focus just on the tech. You just focus on this technology of sustainability. Having the funny gadgets to the power-saving efficiencies. When really you could go low-tech. When really, if you have the technology, it needs to be decentralized. A solar panel on every home owned by the homeowner rather than solar power that's leased. Sustainability that you rent. That could be taken away should something change. Another point to make on this is the trend that sustainable energy is something that only homeowners can afford at the moment. Thus, you have a digital divide, you have food deserts versus food abundance, and now it seems there'll be a gap between rich and poor when it comes to sustainable energy. Middle class and above can afford their own solar panels, but everyone else will just have to stick with what is available. Another example of this is in my own town, you know, you can recycle a compost, but it's a private service that one must pay a monthly fee for. First, you have to know about it, which can be difficult enough as it is, and then you actually have to have the disposable income to have compost pick up, have the time to recycle. These are, in fact, luxuries. Luxuries to be as sustainable as one can be. And this is something that many working class people can't do. Related to this theme of not just relying on the technology, but how we use technology, I'm going to shift to an article from Gizmodo, written by Elisa Walker, and it's simply titled, Ban Cars. That's right, ban cars. She starts, today, 195 countries will announce that even a global effort to reduce emissions probably won't prevent the cataclysmic warming of the planet, also known as climate weirdness. But there is a way we can reach our climate goals. It's not a pledge, it's not a tax, it's easier than that. We ban cars. Sounds like an indecent proposal. But here's the scale of the problem. There are over a billion cars crawling the Earth's surface right now, she says. A number that might double as soon as 2030. As fast that figure grows depends on how dramatically developing nations like China and India experience increases in vehicle ownership. But no single country is currently driving more cars around this planet than the US of A. We got the world in this mess, and this is our problem to fix. Aside from a single panel discussion, the COP21 summit hasn't addressed cars much at all. The UN issued a statement that 25% of all energy-related emissions in the atmosphere are from transportation. The other 75% comes from buildings, a percentage which is expected to grow to a third. This is probably because we're making buildings more efficient. To attempt to reach the climate goals, it says, at least a fifth of all vehicles worldwide should be electric by 2030. But that's not the right way to think about it. Right now, virtually every single electric car, which represents only 0.1% of all cars, is still burning fossil fuels. This is because even if you own an electric car in most states, your electricity comes from coal. So it's like shoveling coal into your EV, electronic vehicle. Even if every car on the planet was magically converted to an electronic vehicle overnight, we wouldn't have the grid infrastructure in place to plug all those cars in. We'd actually have to build out the grid to support it. That means more energy invested in there. It takes a lot of fossil fuels to build the grid for electric cars. Why would we spend the money building a new grid when we could be spending money on reducing our dependence on cars for transportation? It's kind of an ingrown assumption that we still want to use cars for transportation, freedom and whatever and all that. When really, if what we care about is efficiency and saving the planet, well, maybe we should talk about banning cars. She continues, like there is no clean coal, there is no clean car. So we don't have to get more electric cars on the road. We just have to get more cars off the road and fast. She explains car bans. Car bans are as simple as they sound. They restrict private automobiles from entering a city. So she's talking about urban areas. You might have already seen how this works in a pedestrian-prioritized historical district, which is common in bigger cities. So we start the ban there, in big cities. Where about half the world's population lives now, where car ownership is already low, and where existing housing density and transit infrastructure allow people to easily live without automobiles. These are also the places you can make the greatest impact as the population in cities is growing there. 70% worldwide by 2050. But it's not just about banning cars, she continues. It's not also about banning cars. You have to prepare to ban cars. More or less, it's not the passing of a law that bans cars. It's the things you do, the change infrastructure, and other things to allow for people to use cars less, to give up cars. Cities also have to help their citizens live without a car. Proving more taller buildings. Getting rid of parking minimums. Many laws require a minimum amount of parking. And of course, expand public transit options. Build rail instead of roads. Turn gas stations into bike kiosks. Convert parking lots to sidewalks. Provide a fleet of low-speed, zero-emission vehicles, like golf carts, to make deliveries and help residents get around. And introduce better technology solutions for navigation. I'll point out, third voice here, that you probably wouldn't believe how much we're spending on roads and how much we're still spending on roads. How little of the transportation budget goes to not roads. So you might think, oh, we are spending a little more on public transportation, right? Well, maybe a smidgen. But when it comes to my area, wow, not really. It's every dollar has to be fought for bus lines. And we barely have express bus lines in my area. And not to mention bike lanes. Don't get me started. We have like 1 mile of bike lanes in my city. It's pitiful, quite pitiful. And we have to debate about restriping another very wide street to make it, so there are bike lanes there. And it's a big debate. It's a big, long process. It is agonizing. The writer, Alyssa, goes through some examples of cities that are doing this. Oslo is working on banning all cars from its city center by 2019. So is Helsinki, Madrid, Hamburg, and Paris in various ways. So these are all European cities so far. London has heavily restricted them in its downtown. A thriving business district in Johannesburg got rid of all of its cars for a month. Even the U.S. has done this on a smaller scale. New York City has barred them from half of Times Square. I've been there. It's very good. It's basically pedestrianized Broadway. And San Francisco has kicked them off of a stretch of Market Street. So that's a pedestrian district. And that's really how you start. You start with one block, and then you can just move it to a street, and then two streets, to a neighborhood. But usually when you do that, then you basically still need a lot of parking around that pedestrian district. Burlington, Vermont kind of has that problem. And downtowns that want to revive themselves have to build many parking garages. I visited Cleveland, and every third building was a parking garage. It was very sad. You have this dense downtown, and it's basically just like five large buildings, and the rest of it is parking. She goes on with more examples. On any given weekend, cities all over the planet have been setting aside large swaths of neighborhoods for walkers and bikers as part of a regularly scheduled car-free festival. This is something that I think is a UN project. Especially a city in South Korea like went car-free. These are bringing about permanent change, though. Bogota, in Colombia, began banishing cars from its streets every Sunday and used that momentum to develop one of the most inspiring, low-cost transportation systems on the planet in less than 20 years. Cities are already doing this because we know it's better for humans who live there. Science has proven that almost every other way of getting around is better for our bodies and minds. Cars truly are mini jails. And your only outlet is listening to conservative talk radio. Banning cars from major cities worldwide would save millions of lives, and not just by reducing crashes. Removing cars from the road, from roads shows dramatic and immediate improvement not only in carbon emissions, but dangerous particulate matter, various pollution, the kind that kills about 3 million people globally. 3 million globally. Air pollution from cars. Banning cars part of the time, like on alternative days, doesn't work in the long run, because cities are still allowing some cars. People find ways to get around the rules, and cities don't have the money to enforce them. All cars must go. So she's laying out an argument that you really can't do change part way. You can kind of dip your toes in now and then with the pedestrian district. And that's kind of what I meant by explaining the downside of that. If you just go with one neighborhood at a time, or just one neighborhood in your local town, you'll basically end up with car culture all around it, and you'll have to build parking garages, or every block around your pedestrian district will be parking. It's got to be the whole city. And in order to do the whole city, you need to build that new infrastructure. You need to shift spending on roads to everything else. Everything else. Car shares, bike shares, trains, buses, and the like. Can't go halfway. She points out the local prerogative of this, that it's cities that are doing this. It's not going to be on country level, or definitely not a state level. It's where things can be done. Sometimes this is because mayors can act more like despots than state legislators or the Congress. City councils can be unusually, surprisingly weak. So mayors kind of take the lead. If you have a mayor who's ready to make the switch, then you can make the switch. Especially if you have a town like mine, where there is a very old political machine making sure that once the candidate from the club is in office, they don't go anywhere. And then it all becomes a game on who can lobby them best, who can get them to make the decisions that everyone will then follow. Not a very good system, in my opinion. It's quite terrible. She continues. Autonomous zero-emission vehicles can be part of the solution, but only if we think about them as another form of public transit. So she talks about shareable cars, car shares, summable vehicles that will replace taxis. By some estimates, when autonomy arrives, cities will need to reduce the overall space allotted by cars by 85%. Car shares are real. They're happening now. My city has it. It's actually a program being done by the bus system. But what if you don't live in a city? Or don't want to? Banning cars can still benefit you, she argues. Besides the obvious health benefits, less pollution, she means. More efficient transportation systems will make it easier to get where you need to go and reduce the overall cost of goods and services brought to your door. If you need a vehicle out when you live where you live, you can simply borrow one. Kind of a weak argument. She goes on to make an argument of how banning cars can help people in rural areas, particularly with car sharing. But I would argue that if you live in a rural area, cars can still be what you have, how you get around, travel in and out. But with a car-free city, with trains and connections to rural areas, buses, and car shares, rural folks can still be car dependent as well. It can be a result. And certainly, you won't have that sprawl eating up all those rural areas. And that's the greater issue here about cars. Banning cars isn't just about the pollution. It's not just about the parking spaces. It's about all of the energy it takes to have a car-based infrastructure. Even if it's all electric, and all that electricity for your electric cars comes from solar and wind, there's still all the asphalt. There's still all the embodied energy in roads and all the infrastructure for driving. And there's the energy and money it takes to build the new grid for the electric cars. It's so much more time, energy, and money to keep our car-based civilization going. And it just keeps eating up more land, especially as populations increase. She makes a bigger argument. If you don't think that one car will make a difference, consider this. Right now, about 3% of all trips globally are taken by bike. A big study by UC Davis and the Institute of Transportation Development Policy says that reducing car use enough to double that figure to 6% by 2050 could make the game-changing impact. Cities would save $24 trillion. What? Yes, that's how much money it takes to keep roads going, to fix the roads, fix the potholes. And the plan would reduce CO2 emissions by nearly 11%. Not sure that's enough, but again, like I said, quarter of energy use is in transportation, the rest is buildings. So it's definitely not all to do. There's enough to prevent the increase in transportation-related emissions that the UN predicts, and the world would be happier and healthier for it. And then she wraps up with a bolder point that I've heard other urbanists make. A generation from now, we'll look back on this 100-year blip in human history and shake our heads. Remember this failed experiment, our temporary lapse in judgment. But we have to reverse this trend now. Before we hand over any more of our cities to the antiquated, dying technology that's killing us right along with it. Cars aren't an old idea from the past, but believing that cars are the future could very well destroy our entire civilization. And this is the idea that cars are in fact a technological fad. And we've reorganized our entire civilization around cars, around one piece of technology, how our cities are built, how we think about cities. We've created cities without edges. We've created cities that go on as far as you can see and are practically placeless. They have no sense of place. They have no character. It's all just one long commercial strip and housing. So I've covered one topic. I hope you've taken something from this. But for now, I'm recording these as a hobby, as an experiment. All this is a learning experience. I've really enjoyed what other people do with podcasts. And I see some things missing, but I've been growing. So that's my show today. I'll stop there. This has been the Three Less Podcast. Have a wonderful day.